Hello everyone, before we start the episode, I have an important announcement to make about one of our featured cases. After this episode was already recorded, the Williamson County Sheriff's Office announced that DNA from an unknown contributor may have been found on forensic evidence from the Orange Sox case. At the time of this recording, they are performing preliminary tests to determine if there is enough usable DNA to potentially uncover the identity of Orange Sox's killer. In addition, it's also been announced that the DNA Doe Project has taken on this case and are going to attempt to identify the victim. It will probably be months before we know anything, but I will keep you posted with any updates to this case on social media. In the meantime, enjoy the episode. October 31st, 1979. Williamson County, Texas. The nude body of a young woman is discovered in a concrete culvert next to the interstate. She has been strangled to death and is only clad in a pair of orange socks, but since she cannot be identified, Orange Socks becomes her nickname. Serial killer Henry Lee Lucas eventually confesses to her murder and is sentenced to death, but evidence strongly suggests he was not responsible. There is speculation that Orange Socks' case might be connected to another young woman known as the Walker County Jane Doe, who was murdered 1 year later, but both victims remain unidentified. After that, the trail went cold. Hello everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host Robin Warder, and today I'll be covering two murder cases involving unidentified female decedents, known as Orange Socks and the Walker County Jane Doe. As you probably know, our show is going to be spending the month of October covering mysteries which either took place on Halloween or have some sort of Halloween slant to them. Both of these victims were murdered 1 year apart in Texas around Halloween, and there is speculation that the two cases might be connected. Cases involving unidentified John or Jane Does are among the most highly discussed topics among true crime buffs and online sleuths, which is why we have websites like the Doe Network and the National Missing and Unidentified System, aka NAMIS, which have entire databases devoted to decedents whose true identities have never been established. I haven't done an episode about an unidentified decedent in a while, because unfortunately, there often isn't a whole lot of material to talk about in these stories. But that's certainly not the case with Orange Socks, as there's a lot of controversy about the fact that her murder was pinned on notorious serial killer Henry Lee Lucas, who pretty much holds the record for confessing to murders he did not commit. There are enough compelling similarities between the murders of Orange Socks and the Walker County Jane Doe to suggest they may have been killed by the same perpetrator, so I'm going to explore both their stories on this episode. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, and we've also recently been added to Spotify as well. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of these sites to help spread the word. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now start off by discussing the murder of Orange Socks. Our story begins in Williamson County, Texas on Halloween in 1979. That afternoon, the nude body of a young white female was discovered lying face down in a concrete culvert next to Interstate 35, located very close to Georgetown. She carried no identification, but was estimated to be between 15 and 30 years old, and the only piece of clothing she had on were a pair of orange socks. Because of the large amount of bruising on her neck, the cause of death was determined to be strangulation. Her murder likely took place only a few hours before she was discovered, and the scratches and bruises on her back seem to indicate that whoever killed her likely dragged her body over the guardrail and through some grass, and then dumped her into the culvert. The victim's height was around 5'8" and 5'10", and her weight was between 140 and 160 pounds. She had reddish-brown hair, hazel eyes, thick eyebrows, pierced ears, and a quarter-inch hairline scar under her chin. Even though her teeth were in relatively good condition, two of them were missing. She had dirty fingernails which were painted reddish-pink, very long toenails, and her legs were unshaven, with insect bite scars on them. It would also turn out that the victim suffered from chronic salpingitis, an inflammation of the fallopian tubes, which was likely the result of having previously contracted gonorrhea. Other items found at the scene included an oval-shaped silver ring on her finger with an abalone shell or mother-of-pearl stone in the center, and two matchbooks, one from a Motel 6 and the other from a Holiday Inn in Henrietta, Oklahoma. There was also a bloody towel found, which the victim had likely used as a sanitary napkin for menstruation in order to avoid spending money to purchase tampons. However, in spite of these clues, all attempts to identify the victim were unsuccessful, and she would remain classified as a Jane Doe. She was buried at Oddfellows Cemetery under a headstone which simply read, "Unidentified Woman," but she would become best known by her nickname, Orange Socks. For over 3 years, there was little progress identifying Orange Socks, or her killer, until the notorious Henry Lee Lucas entered the picture. Now, if you're not familiar with Lucas, he is one of the most infamous serial killers of the modern era, but no one can be certain just how many people he actually murdered. We know that his first confirmed murder took place in 1960, when he murdered his own mother, and spent over a decade in prison for the crime before he was released. In 1983, Lucas was arrested on a weapons charge, but would soon surprise everyone by confessing to the murders of 82-year-old Kate Rich and 15-year-old Frida Becky Powell, the niece of his longtime partner in crime, Otis Toole. And this was only the beginning. Over the next several years, Lucas would confess to a total of around 600 unsolved murders, which took place in 27 different states in Canada. Officially, Lucas was charged and convicted of 10 of those murders, which earned him one death sentence, six life sentences, and an additional 210 years in prison. Of course, the vast majority of his confessions were false, and there's doubt that he even committed all the crimes he was convicted of. Lucas recanted most of his confessions, and at one point, even went so far as to claim that the only person he actually killed was his mother, and that he was completely innocent of all the other crimes. Once word spread that Lucas would pretty much confess to anything, many police departments were happy to allow him to take credit for any unsolved murders they had on the books, and they would often feed him details about the cases before he made his official confession. And some of Lucas's claims were completely outlandish, as he even went so far as to take credit for the murder of Jimmy Hoffa, and said that he was the one who provided cyanide to Jim Jones before all his followers were poisoned at Jonestown. It seemed that Lucas would make these false confessions in exchange for better living conditions in prison, and by his own admission, he sometimes liked to do this because he wanted to make the police look stupid. Anyway, perhaps the most controversial confession Lucas made was to the murder of Orange Socks, as it nearly led to him being executed. In 1983, Lucas confessed to picking up Orange Socks while hitchhiking in Oklahoma City. He said that she told him her name was Judy or Joni, but he couldn't remember for sure. Anyway, Lucas claimed that he stopped and had sex with Orange Socks at some point, but found the experience to be unsatisfying. Later on, Lucas pulled over and demanded sex with her again, but she said, "Not right now," and attempted to leave the car. He responded by strangling her to death, and proceeded to strip her of everything but her orange socks before he raped her dead body. Lucas then drove to Williamson County and dumped Orange Socks into the concrete culvert next to Interstate 35. He even visited the location with investigators and showed them how he dragged her body over the guardrail. Lucas was subsequently charged with Orange Socks' murder and went on trial the following year. By this point, he had already been convicted of the murders of Kate Rich and Becky Powell, but this time, there were compelling reasons to believe that Lucas could not have committed this crime. Other than his confession, there was no other evidence to implicate Lucas, and he had made a number of conflicting statements. Lucas recanted his confession and claimed that he took credit for Orange Sox's murder because he wanted to die and hoped to commit, quote-unquote, legal suicide by receiving the death penalty. He said that he had been shown the case file and photos of the crime scene during his interrogation. While audio and video of Lucas's confession was shown in court during the trial, it had been subject to significant editing, leading to speculation that investigators had removed sections where they fed him details about the crime. Another point which supported the idea that Lucas's confession was false was that when the pathologist did an autopsy on Orange Sox's body, he found no signs of sexual assault, even though Lucas had claimed to have raped her corpse. And as you'll recall, the victim was discovered to have had salpingitis, which was the result of having contracted gonorrhea, but even though he supposedly had sex with her, there was no record of Lucas ever having contracted any venereal diseases. But the most important piece of evidence in Lucas's favor was his seemingly airtight alibi, as his defense team produced a timesheet which showed that he was working in Jacksonville, Florida on October 31, 1979, as a roofer at a naval air station. Now, during his original confession, Lucas had stated that he paid off his foreman to falsify his timesheet and record him as working that day, even though he was absent. However, there was no evidence to substantiate this, and the defense countered with a signed paycheck which Lucas had cashed in Jacksonville on November 1st. So even if Lucas's timesheet had been falsified, and he was murdering Orange Sox in Texas on October 31st, he still would have had to make it to Jacksonville to cash the check the following day. This was a distance of over 1,040 miles, meaning that Lucas would have had to drive at speeds of around 70 miles per hour the entire time without stopping, which pretty much seemed impossible. But in spite of this, after deliberating for only 40 minutes, the jury still found him guilty of the murder and sentenced him to death via lethal injection. Well, even though there was no doubt that Lucas was a killer who deserved to be in prison, there was a lot of controversy about the fact that he was scheduled to be executed for one crime he probably did not commit. The verdict was appealed several times, and on June 26, 1998, 4 days before his execution, Lucas was given a reprieve. On the recommendation of the Texas Board of Pardons and Parole, Governor George W. Bush decided to commute Lucas's death sentence to life imprisonment. In 2001, Lucas died of heart failure, but was technically never cleared of Orange Sox's murder, and is still officially listed on the record as her killer. And even though the case generated a lot of publicity over the controversy surrounding Lucas's death sentence, Orange Sox could still not be identified. She was featured on America's Most Wanted twice, and they would receive a tip from an anonymous female caller who claimed she had seen the victim hitchhiking in Georgetown on the day she was killed, but this information didn't lead to any breakthroughs on the case. Of course, ever since the inception of the Doe Network and Namus, one of the favorite activities among online sleuths has been attempting to match up unidentified decedents with missing persons. Altogether, a total of 8 young women who went missing around the same time period as Orange Sox was murdered have officially been ruled out as being her. However, there has been some speculation that the same person who killed Orange Sox may have also murdered another unidentified young woman in Texas 1 year later. At around 9:20 a.m. on November 1, 1980, a truck driver traveling northbound on Interstate Highway 45 in Walker County noticed the nude body of a deceased woman lying face down 20 feet away from the road. The location was next to Sam Houston National Forest, 2 miles outside the town of Huntsville. After the police arrived, it was determined that the victim was between 14 and 20 years old, and that she had been strangled to death with a pair of pantyhose. After the police arrived, it was determined that the victim was between 14 and 20 years old. The time of death was approximately 6 hours before the body's discovery, and she had clearly gone through a terrible ordeal. The victim had been strangled to death with a ligature, and was severely beaten, as her body contained numerous bruises, her right eye was swollen shut, and there was a visible bite mark on her right shoulder. In addition, the woman was sexually assaulted with a large blunt instrument, both vaginally and anally. Since no semen was found at the scene, they were unable to conclusively determine if she had been raped by her attacker. Fragments of underwear and pantyhose were found inside her vaginal cavity, and it was theorized that they were placed there to prevent bleeding while her body was being transported to the spot where she was dumped. The presence of the pantyhose fragments made investigators suspect that a pair of pantyhose had been used to strangle her. The victim's height was somewhere between 5 feet and 5 foot 6, and she weighed between 105 and 120 pounds. She had reddish-brown hair, hazel eyes, pierced ears, pink-painted toenails, and extensive dental work on her teeth. And since she also happened to be well-nourished, this led to speculation that she hailed from a middle-class background where she was well cared for. Some of her most distinctive features included a scar above her right eyebrow and an inverted right nipple. Even though the victim's clothing was never found, a pair of high-heeled red leather sandals with light brown straps were at the scene, and she also wore a gold chain necklace around her neck with a rectangular brown pendant containing a smoky blue or brown glass stone. But much like with orange socks, there was no identification for this girl, so she became known as the Walker County Jane Doe. However, unlike the Orange Socks case, there were multiple witnesses who interacted with the Walker County Jane Doe shortly before she was killed, and shared some interesting pieces of information. At around 6:30 p.m. on Halloween night, a teenage girl matching Jane Doe's description arrived at the South End Golf gas station in Huntsville. According to the manager, she was dropped off by an unidentified white male driving a blue 1970s model Chevrolet Caprice. She was described as wearing a dirty yellow pullover shirt, a white knit sweater with big pockets that fell past her waistline, and a pair of jeans. She also happened to be carrying a pair of red sandals, which matched the description of the sandals found at the murder scene. The girl spoke to the station manager and asked for directions to the Ellis Prison Unit, which was located 20 miles from the gas station and 14 miles from the spot where Jane Doe's body was eventually discovered. After the manager gave her the directions, she left on foot. Later that evening, Jane Doe was seen by two employees at the Hitch and Post truck stop located on Interstate 45. Once again, she asked for directions to the Ellis Prison Unit, and this time, she claimed that she was going to see a friend there. As one of the employees drew a map to the location, the other employee, a waitress, had a conversation with the girl. When asked how old she was, the girl replied, 19, but the waitress thought she looked younger and suspected she was a teenage runaway. Jane Doe claimed she hailed from the Aransas Pass Rockport area of Texas, located around 260 miles away. When the waitress asked the girl if her parents knew where she was, she replied, "Who cares?" After receiving the map to the prison, Jane Doe left the truck stop, and this would be the last reported sighting of her until her body was discovered the following morning. Well, these new tidbits of information would only provide more unanswered questions. Photographs of the victim were circulated among inmates and staff at the Ellis unit, but no one admitted to recognizing her. She could not be matched to any reports about missing girls in the area, and a check into the Aransas Pass Rockport area, where she claimed she was from, also turned up empty. Investigators could not find anyone who knew the girl, and no one ever came forward to identify her body. In January of 1981, the Walker County Jane Doe was buried in Huntsville's Oakwood Cemetery under a donated headstone, which read, "Unknown White Female." Inevitably, given the similarities between the two deaths, and the gap of almost exactly 1 year, there was speculation that the killer of Walker County Jane Doe and Orange Socks might have been the same person. Of course, Henry Lee Lucas was looked at as a possible suspect in this crime as well, and ironically enough, he would be incarcerated on death row at Ellis Unit after he was convicted of Orange Socks' murder. The bite mark found on Jane Doe's right shoulder did not match Lucas, but because he had dental reconstruction performed before he went to prison, this didn't rule him out. However, as far as I can tell, Lucas never did confess to killing Walker County Jane Doe, and there's no evidence linking him to the crime. In 1999, her remains were exhumed in order to obtain a DNA sample. Much like with Orange Socks' case, attempts have been made to match Jane Doe to other teenage girls who disappeared around the same time period, and thus far, 16 missing females have officially been ruled out as being her. In fact, two of them have been featured on this podcast. 17-year-old Rachel Trelisa of the Fort Worth 3 case, who vanished in 1974, and 14-year-old Lorraine Ron, who went missing from Manchester, New Hampshire, 6 months before Jane Doe was murdered. In December of 2015, shortly after the case was reopened by the Walker County Sheriff's Office and a new composite sketch was released of the victim, there would be an interesting development. A brother and sister came forward to describe an encounter they had with someone who they believed might have been Walker County Jane Doe. Sometime after April in 1980, the two siblings, who were still kids at the time, were staying at a motel somewhere in Texas with their mother and stepfather. They thought the motel was likely in Beeville, though they can't be 100% certain. Anyway, the siblings befriended a teenage girl there who said her name was probably Kathy, though it may have possibly been Katie or Kathleen. Kathy said she was 14 years old and originally hailed from Corpus Christi, and even though she was staying at the motel with a couple in their 30s, Kathy claimed she was a runaway. They remembered her wearing clothing which was similar to the clothes Walker County Jane Doe was seen wearing, and she often liked to carry around her shoes in her hands. The brother also recalled that Kathy said that she was planning to visit a friend who was incarcerated at the prison in the town of Sugarland. She even asked the sibling's stepfather for a ride to the prison, but he declined. Anyway, at one point, the sister and Kathy posed for a photograph together, and since it was still in the sibling's possession after all these years, the photo was shared on the Facebook page, Who Was Walker County Jane Doe, in hopes that someone would recognize Kathy. Unfortunately, the manager from the gas station and the two employees from the truck stop were all deceased by this point, so they could not be shown the photo and confirm if Kathy was the same girl they spoke to on Halloween night in 1980. Thus far, no one has come forward to conclusively identify Kathy, so for now, both the Walker County Jane Doe and Orange Sox remain unidentified. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. Anyway, as you well know, there are sadly thousands of cases listed on the Doe Network and NamUs about decedents who have never been identified. I mentioned earlier that online sleuths often attempt to match up unidentified decedents with missing persons, and sometimes these efforts do pay off and the victims get their identities back. But in many of these stories, the decedent turns out to be someone who isn't even listed in any of the online missing persons databases because they were never officially reported missing to begin with. These particular cases wind up getting solved when someone happens to come across a composite sketch of the decedent and notices that they bear a striking resemblance to a person they once knew but haven't seen in a long time and whose current whereabouts are unknown. While the case hasn't been solved yet, we've seen this exact thing happen with Walker County Jane Doe, where a pair of siblings saw a composite sketch and thought she resembled a girl they crossed paths with 35 years beforehand. There are many cases involving John or Jane Doe's which have become heavily discussed online, but I think Orange Sox and Walker County Jane Doe are considered to be two of the more upsetting ones. Not only were both these victims murdered in an incredibly brutal fashion, but no one ever came forward to claim their bodies, and they had to be buried in graves with headstones which didn't even have names. I mean, how tragic is it when you have to be named after a pair of orange socks you were wearing after your nude body was found? There's a lot to suggest that both these young women were living transient lifestyles and may not have had anyone in their lives who cared about them or were actively looking for them. In each of these particular cases, we have two unsolved mysteries: the identities of the victims and the identity of their killer. So let's start off by discussing orange socks. From a legal standpoint, there is technically only one mystery in this case, since the state still officially recognizes Henry Lee Lucas as her killer. Even though he did have his death sentence commuted, his conviction was not actually overturned, so he never was cleared of this crime. While I hate to profess the innocence of an individual as evil as Henry Lee Lucas, I do think the evidence makes it very clear that he did not murder Orange Sox. But any time you're dealing with Lucas in trying to figure out what crimes he did or did not commit, the waters just become so murky. Interestingly enough, one of the other 9 crimes Lucas was convicted of was the murder of another unidentified Jane Doe, who was discovered strangled to death on March 17, 1983 in Montgomery County near Interstate 45. He pleaded guilty to that crime and received an additional life sentence months after he was convicted of Orange Sox's murder. Sadly, it doesn't look like this unidentified victim is even profiled on the Doe Network, but given Lucas's propensity for false confessions, who knows if he actually did kill her. However, let's get back to this case. It's quite fascinating to see that during his tenure as governor of Texas, George W. Bush oversaw a total of 152 executions, and the only time he ever commuted a death sentence was for Henry Lee Lucas, who was obviously the last person the anti-death penalty crowd would want to use as a poster child. While no one will ever know just how many crimes he committed, Lucas was certainly guilty of at least one or more of the murders he was convicted of, and deserved to be incarcerated for the rest of his life. But it's a big problem when the only murder he actually received a death sentence for was one he could not have done, as he had concrete evidence placing him in Florida at the time Orange Sox was murdered. It really bothers me in cases like this, where a defendant has an airtight alibi placing them a long distance away from where a crime took place, and the prosecution has to play all sorts of mental gymnastics to come up with a scenario to prove they still could have done it. You've seen examples of this in previous episodes of mine, such as when Dennis Perry was convicted of the murders of Harold and Thelma Swain, and James Harry Reyes was convicted of the murder of Father Patrick Ryan. In both cases, the defendants had alibis which seemed to place them hundreds of miles away when the crimes took place. For this case, the prosecution had to accuse Lucas's foreman of taking bribes to falsify his timesheet, and Henry Lee Lucas does not strike me as a sophisticated criminal mastermind who would dream up a plan to falsify an alibi for himself while he traveled out of state. They also had to explain how Lucas could have cashed a check in Florida on November 1st when he was murdering Orange Sox in Texas the previous day. Without a plane ticket, it would take around 15 hours to drive over 1,040 miles from Williamson County to Jacksonville, and Lucas probably would have had to be the Flash in order to pull that off. You might be wondering how, even with convincing alibi evidence, the jury would convict Lucas of Orange Sox's murder after deliberating for only 40 minutes, but I can see how this would happen. While the only evidence against Lucas was his confession, the general public would not have been as knowledgeable about the issue of false confessions in wrongful conviction cases back in 1984. By this point, Lucas was an infamous killer who had already been convicted of two murders, so if the jury heard a recording of him confessing to another murder, what reason would they have to disbelieve him? I guess it's tempting to think that since Lucas murdered so many other people anyway, does it really matter if he's guilty or innocent of this particular crime? Well, the problem with that mentality is that if Lucas takes credit for Orange Sox's murder and is wrongly convicted for it, then the real killer gets away with it. Lucas claimed that he picked up Orange Sox while he was hitchhiking and murdered her, and I think there's a good chance this exact scenario happened with another perpetrator. Sadly, it seems apparent that Orange Sox lived a very rough life before her death. This might explain why she was estimated to be between 15 and 30 years old, which seems like a pretty large age gap. When her body was found, she was unkempt, had unshaven legs, was suffering from self-angitis, and was using a towel as a sanitary napkin, probably because she couldn't afford to buy tampons. All indications are that she lived a poverty-stricken, transient lifestyle, and she may have also been a sex worker. For all we know, she may have never had a normal home life, or ran away from home at a young age, which is why no one is actively looking for her. Unfortunately, unlike Walker County Jane Doe, it doesn't appear there were any eyewitnesses who recalled seeing Orange Sox prior to her death, aside from the anonymous female caller who thought she saw her hitchhiking. Now, as you might be aware, this is not the only podcast episode I've released involving Orange Sox. Last year, I did an episode about the Orange Sox murders, which took place just over 2 years later, in January of 1982. It involved two young women, Bobby Oberholzer and Annette Schnee, who were both murdered on the same night at different times by the same perpetrator after they were picked up hitchhiking in Breckenridge, Colorado. The reason they were able to figure out both victims were killed by the same person is because an orange sock belonging to Annette Schnee was found at Bobby Oberholzer's murder scene. And yes, Henry Lee Lucas was briefly looked at as a suspect in these murders, since he had once bragged about murdering a woman in Colorado in 1982, but nothing actually links him to the crime. Now, I see no reason to believe that Orange Sox's case is connected to this one, as it's probably just a coincidence that both crimes happen to involve victims wearing orange socks. But hey, Colorado is just northwest of Texas, there's only a 2-year gap, and it seems likely that all three victims were murdered after being picked up while hitchhiking. So if the same killer was responsible for all these crimes, I wouldn't be overly surprised. However, I think now would be a good time to discuss the likelihood of Orange Sox's case being connected to Walker County Jane Doe. Both these murders took place almost exactly 1 year apart and around 150 miles away from each other. They each involved young women being strangled to death before their nude bodies were dumped by the side of the interstate, and neither of the victims' clothing was ever found. But in Walker County Jane Doe's case, there are more clues to piece together, since witnesses actually spoke to her in the hours before she was killed. As you recall, she was asking for directions to visit a friend at the Ellis Prison Unit, claimed she was 19 years old, and said she was from the Aransas-Rockport area, and when asked if her parents knew where she was, she replied, "Who cares?" Of course, the waitress who spoke with Jane Doe did not believe she looked 19, and thought she may have been as young as 14. Her response about her parents could be seen as an indication that she was estranged from her family, but given that she was a teenager, it's possible that "who cares" was simply a sarcastic reaction to indicate that she didn't want to talk anymore. Her mentioning that she was from the Aransas-Rockport area is curious, since investigators could not find anyone there who recognized her, which would mean that she was either lying, or she hadn't lived there in many years, or she was running away from people who genuinely did not care about her. But her claims about visiting a friend at the Ellis Unit are the most curious part of her story, since no one from there, including inmates and staff, admitted to recognizing her or knowing who she was. Of course, given that these were convicted criminals, it's certainly possible that one of them did recognize her and chose to remain silent for whatever reason. Regardless, it is pretty unusual for a teenage girl to be visiting a prison alone. Ellis Unit was not exactly a minimum security facility for non-violent offenders, as it housed some of the worst criminals in the state. In fact, it was the location of Texas's male death row at that time, and it eventually became Henry Lee Lucas's home. So let's look at the timeline of Walker County Jane Doe's whereabouts on Halloween night. She was first seen arriving at the South End Golf Station at 6:30 p.m., which was 20 miles from the Ellis Unit. As far as I know, prisons do not allow their inmates to receive visitors late at night, so if she was planning to visit someone at Ellis Unit, I assume the earliest she could have done so is the following day. Even though the gas station manager gave her directions to the prison, she must have taken a wrong turn somewhere, since the Hitch and Post truck stop was 5 miles in the opposite direction. I don't know the exact time she arrived at the truck stop and spoke to the waitress, but on foot, it would have taken her nearly 2 hours to get there from the gas station, so let's just say she arrived at 8:30 p.m. It was determined that she was murdered approximately 6 hours before her body was found, which would place her time of death as between 3 o'clock and 3:30 a.m. So after she left the truck stop, there's a window of about 7 hours when her whereabouts are unaccounted for. It's a reasonable assumption that Jane Doe would have attempted to hitch a ride to the prison, but the location of her body was a couple miles northwest of the truck stop, in the opposite direction of Ellis Unit. Since she wouldn't have been able to enter the prison until the following day, she may have crossed paths with a truck driver and asked if she could spend the night in his truck, but he subsequently killed her. Of course, the gas station manager recalled her being dropped off there in a blue Chevrolet driven by a white male, and as far as I know, he was never identified. If Jane Doe was in fact Kathy, the girl from the motel in Beeville, the driver may have been the male from the couple she was staying with there. But the most likely explanation is that this guy was probably just a random motorist who picked up Jane Doe hitchhiking, and for whatever reason, he could only take her as far as the gas station. If they had been able to track this man down, he might have been able to provide more information about Jane Doe and why she was visiting the Ellis Unit. Now, assuming that she was telling the truth about this, and none of the inmates are lying about recognizing her, the alternate explanation is that she may have been going to see someone whom she had been communicating with, but never actually met before. For instance, if she had become pen pals with one of the inmates, and they were writing letters back and forth, the inmate may not have known what she looked like. So when Jane Doe's photograph was circulated at the prison, he didn't recognize her, or put two and two together, and figure out she was his pen pal. Another theory I've seen pushed forward is that perhaps a relative whom she never met, or hadn't seen in a long time, such as her father, was incarcerated there, and she was planning to surprise them. Regardless, one thing which seems certain is that whatever her intentions, Jane Doe crossed paths with the wrong person before she reached the prison. But what really stands out here is the sheer viciousness of the crime, as she was sexually assaulted with a blunt instrument. In 2002, journalist Michael Hargreaves published an article about the case for East Texas Today magazine titled "Whose Child Is This?" He presented a unique theory. What if her killer was a female? This theory was bolstered by the fact that no semen was found on her body or at the scene, as a female perpetrator might have decided that using an object was the best way to assault her. Well, I don't know about that. Just because there was no semen does not necessarily prove that a woman did it. That could be the result of a male attacker being impotent, which prompted him to take out his rage with an object. The impotence theory might also explain why Orange Socks was not sexually assaulted, even though she was found nude. Or perhaps the simplest explanation is that the perpetrator was just a sick individual who got a thrill from assaulting a girl with an object. But if there's one aspect of the murder that might point towards a female killer, it's the fact that Jane Doe may have been strangled by a pair of pantyhose. While there was no pantyhose found at the scene, pieces of pantyhose were found in her vaginal cavity in an apparent attempt to stop the bleeding. It doesn't seem like the pantyhose would have belonged to Jane Doe, because she was seen wearing jeans the previous night, and I have my doubt she would be wearing pantyhose underneath them. So what if the pantyhose belonged to the killer? Of course, that doesn't prove a female was the perpetrator, as a male could have easily been carrying it around with them for other reasons. Of course, in recent years, we've had a promising lead about the possible identity of Walker County Jane Doe, and that's the photograph of the girl known as Kathy, which was taken by the siblings who befriended her at a motel sometime in 1980. I have to admit, looking at the photo, I can definitely see a resemblance, but not so much that it makes me want to cry out, "That's definitely her." I guess what makes Kathy such an intriguing potential match is the similarities in their backstories. Even though she was staying at a motel with an older couple, she said she was a runaway, so this couple was presumably not her parents. She also wanted to go visit a friend at a prison, though in this particular case, it was the prison in Sugar Land, not Ellis Unit. And since she asked the sibling's stepfather for a ride, it doesn't sound like she was planning to visit the prison with the couple she was with. It's also interesting how Kathy was described as often carrying her shoes around in her hands, like Jane Doe when she was seen carrying her leather sandals at the gas station. And looking at the photo of Kathy, I notice she is wearing a necklace of some sort, though it's concealed underneath her shirt. I'd be very curious to know if it was a rectangular brown pendant with a glass stone, which was found around Jane Doe's neck. However, it must be said that 35 years had passed by the time these siblings came forward, so I can see how their memories might not be entirely clear. While the brother remembered the detail of Kathy wanting to visit the prison in Sugarland, his sister did not recall this. But like I mentioned earlier, it is pretty unusual for teenage girls to hitch a ride to visit a prison alone, and this occurrence took place in Texas in the months prior to Jane Doe's death, so it is a compelling connection. Let's assume the detail about Sugarland is correct, and the motel they were staying at was actually in Beeville, which is over 250 miles away from Huntsville. Sugarland is over 160 miles from Beeville, so I can see why the stepfather would not want to give Kathy a ride there. Sugarland is also about 90 miles from Huntsville, and their central unit prison has since been closed. If Kathy and Jane Doe were one and the same, I don't know if she was planning to visit someone who had been transferred from Sugarland to the Ellis unit, or if she was just mistaken about where they were incarcerated. Another thing I find fascinating is that some online sleuths who've seen Kathleen's photo believe she bears a striking resemblance to Julianne Mosley from the Fort Worth 3 case, and I tend to agree. As you'll recall, Julianne went missing with two other teenage girls in Fort Worth, Texas, on December 23, 1974, when she was 9 years old. Well, Kathy said she was from Corpus Christi, not Fort Worth, and Julianne would have been 15 years old in 1980, not 14 like Kathleen claimed. but if you compare the photos of Julianne and Kathleen, it does look like they could be the same girl with a 6-year age difference. However, given the circumstances of the Fort Worth 3 case, I've always leaned towards Julianne and the other two girls being killed shortly after she disappeared. As far as I can tell, Julianne did not come from a broken home and had no reason to run away, so the odds of her hanging out with some random couple and hitchhiking through Texas years later are unlikely. But if Kathy is not Walker County Jane Doe, I do believe she probably was a runaway of some sort, because even though her photo has been posted online for nearly 3 years now, no one has come forward to say they recognized her. So did the same perpetrator murder both Orange Sox and Walker County Jane Doe? That's certainly a possibility. In 2017, KHOU 11 News in Houston published an article which stated that investigators were looking into a possible connection between Walker County Jane Doe's case and the murders of three other victims who were found dead alongside Interstate 45 North in Texas in 1980. They declined to provide many specific details about these other three victims, only that two of them were still unidentified, some of them had been sexually assaulted in a similar manner to Walker County Jane Doe, and they were all described as, quote-unquote, high-risk victims. One of these other victims was found in Houston, which is 70 miles away from Huntsville, while the other two were close to Houston. I'd say there's a good possibility that the killer of at least some of these women either picked them up hitchhiking or picked them up for sex and subsequently murdered them. I'm not sure if all these murders would have been committed by the same perpetrator, but there's been no shortage over the years of serial killers who were truck drivers. The unfortunate thing is that if Orange Sox and Walker County Jane Doe were both murdered by a random predator who picked them up hitchhiking, then the killer might not have even known who they were, so catching them would probably not help much at uncovering their true identities. However, while the reasonable assumption may be that both of these young women were estranged from their families and no one cared about them, that doesn't necessarily mean that they don't have relatives still out there somewhere who are wondering what happened to them. In the past few years, we've had a number of decedents get identified after going unclaimed for decades, and it turns out their families never officially reported them missing. Just a few months ago, one of the most famous unidentified decedents ever, Lyle Stevick, was finally traced back to his biological family, though at the time of this recording, they've elected not to reveal his real name or any details of his backstory in order to respect the family's privacy. But just because a decedent was never reported missing does not mean their family did not care. As examples, I've done episodes about Canadian victims named Dickie Hovey, Eric Jones, and Reet Jurvetson, who ventured off on their own in the late 1960s and wound up getting murdered, but they remained unidentified decedents for over 40 years until DNA testing matched them to their surviving relatives. In all of these cases, the victims were not estranged from their families. They just left their original hometowns to travel a great distance away, and their families simply stopped hearing from them. Since this wasn't the age of instant communication, their loved ones just assumed they'd gone off and started a new life somewhere. They did make attempts to report them missing, but as I mentioned on my podcast numerous times, law enforcement did not do a great job at handling cases involving missing young people from the 60s until the early 80s. If there was no direct evidence of foul play, they were often just written off as runaways. So that's why there was never any official missing persons report on file for them, and it was only through the miracle of sharp-eyed people browsing the internet that they were eventually matched up to an unclaimed murder victim. Since the victims on this episode were murdered in 1979 and 1980, when it was still common for missing young women to be treated as runaways, the same logic applies. So even if Orange Sox and Walker County Jane Doe were runaways living a transient lifestyle, they still could have had family members who attempted to find out what happened to them, but just hit a brick wall when they attempted to involve the police. In the past few years, we've seen a number of female murder victims get their identities back decades after they were murdered, such as Tammy Jo Alexander, aka the Caledonia Jane Doe, and Marcia King, aka Buckskin Girl. In both cases, the victims still had surviving relatives, which made a conclusive DNA match possible. We still don't know who actually killed these women, but uncovering their identities is a good first step. In the case of Buckskin Girl, her identity was made possible by the DNA Doe Project, who have taken on a number of cases in which decedents have been identified through genetic genealogy, including Lyle Stevick and Joseph Newton Chandler III. If they ever decide to take on the Orange Sox and Walker County Jane Doe cases, that could go a long way at helping them get their names back. Until that happens, we'll have to hope that the right person recognizes these two victims someday and sets the wheels in motion. So if you happen to have any information about the identity of Orange Sox, please contact the Williamson County Sheriff's Office at 512-943-1300. That's 512-943-1300. And if you have any info about the Walker County Jane Doe, please contact the Walker County Sheriff's Office at 936-435-2400. That's 936-435-2400. I will post up links to both of their profile pages at the Doe Network, which contains all their essential information, in our episode description. And if you happen to know the identity of the girl in the photograph, known only as Kathy, please visit the Who Was Walker County Jane Doe Facebook page for more information. But if you just have your own thoughts about either of these cases, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email at robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you have a moment, please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We've released some exclusive bonus episodes for our donors in tiers 2 and 3. Last month, we did an episode about the Michael Scott Martin final appeal case from Unsolved Mysteries, and coming up very soon, we've got a special Halloween-themed bonus episode planned for October. So to learn more information, feel free to visit our Patreon page. I'd also like to take a moment to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon, and they are James L. and Jeff B. And I've also been sending out special thank yous to all our loyal patrons who have signed up with us on Patreon when we initially launched there in April, and have continued to support us all the way. I've been thanking you all in increments of 20, so today I will express my thanks to Brianna L., Heather H., DJS, Rhonda A., Michael K., Aaron P., Brenda L., Sonia G., Joshua S., Carissa S., Matt D., Karen S., Keisha R., Stacy R., Josoyo, Lindsay K., Jake, Rachel H. from the Years in Murder podcast, and the Canadian True Crime and Minds of Madness podcasts. Thank you all so much for your support. Also, just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online Forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. Need to provide a big thanks to McGill Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. And as you probably heard, we've brought back his spooky Halloween-themed version of the Trail Went Cold theme for this month's episodes. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, or Spotify. So have yourself a good week, and join me next Wednesday for another Halloween-themed episode of The Trail Went Cold. ¶¶